Thank you.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. My name is Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Joe. Thank everybody or anybody that had anything to do with inviting me to come here. I'm honored to be here, and I'm having a great time. I also want to thank Rose for her talk yesterday evening. Chris, I want to thank Chet. One of the best traditions. I'm going to be interviewed sometime next week by a guy who's writing a book on the traditions or something for the Grapevine, and he's going to interview me, and I'm not going to be interviewed till I listen to Chris's, to Chet's CD on this. I mean, he nailed it, and it was just a great, and the speakers have been great. The speakers beyond me are also going to be great. Doug and Carla, who are kind of newlyweds, gave a great talk on relationships in sobriety. And what they said was, what I heard, because these are the things I think are the hub of a relationship in sobriety. There's a spirit of the universe that underlies the totality of things. Therefore, the spirit in me is the spirit in her. And we fell in love when we were in the seventh grade because our spirits resonated and we knew that we were one. When we were 20 years old, we got married in order to nurture the oneness of the spirit. And we're still together because we're going to God together. And I heard that in you guys' talk. It was just super. I sometimes talk, well, now I got sober. Oh, we tell that, don't we? August the 4th, 1972 is my sobriety date. And in sharing my story, I generally get up to my ninth year of sobriety. Now I've had about 30 years of sobriety since then, but I put stuff in that I'm going to try to leave out. I certainly don't want to leave the fact that Pat and I are still in love. We've been married now 58 years, and if we live another 10, we're going to be together for 68. I mean, we know that. But I generally talk a lot about our childhood relationship, which wasn't that happy anyway, and so I'm going to leave that out. I'm also going to leave out that we have three wonderful kids who are now fathers and grandfathers, and I'm a great grandfather. So, and that's very important in my life, but I'm going to leave that out of my talk, I think. I don't know, therefore, what I'm going to say. I will say, 1,000 years ago, I was born in Los Angeles. I don't remember any of Los Angeles when I was a kid, because the first home I found that I remember was a little farm community about 46 miles southwest of Wichita, Kansas. We thought we were in the Bible Belt. As it got a little older, we went into Oklahoma on a visit. They think they're in the Bible Belt. Texans think they're in the Bible Belt. Nebraska, South Dakota, North, you know, everybody thinks they're in the Bible Belt. That's not true. The people in New York City and in California are not in the Bible Belt. And they know they're not. And I'm telling you, they are happy. But nobody knows exactly where the Bible Belt is, but I know that it buckles about 46 miles southwest of Wichita, Kansas, in this little town that I grew up in. And if I have ever grown up, I started out growing up in that little town. And it was a small little farm community, and the businessmen in the community would put on free movies on Friday night, maybe Saturday night, to attract the farmers into our town so they'd buy their groceries, get their hair cut, and all that in our community. And at one of those free movies, I saw a travelogue movie entitled, I think, Training Wild Elephants in India. I know that was what it was about. They rounded up the wild elephants. They took the baby elephants out of the herd, and they started their training by putting a rope around their right front leg and then snubbing them up to a big tree. And the baby elephant fought and tugged and fought and tugged, tears running down its face, until it come to believe that when that rope's tight, it's futile to pull. Then they go on with the rest of the training, the trainer making sure that he reinforces that truth about when the rope's tight for the rest of the elephant's training. And at the end of the movie, there was this huge elephant. They'd cut down a tree, cut the limbs off the tree, hooked that tree onto the elephant's harness, and he would drag it out of the forest for harvest. And at lunch, in order to hold the big elephant where they wanted it, they put a rope around his right front leg. They drove a stake deep enough in the ground that when they put the other end of the rope around that stake and the elephant could walk around, he would, but when the rope got tight on his right leg, he couldn't pull. Now, the stake didn't hold the elephant. The rope didn't hold the elephant. What held the elephant was the limiting belief they had imposed on him when he was a baby. I came to AA, I heard this great speaker, Don Gates, and he was talking about why he was a Republican or a Democrat. I don't remember which one he was. But he articulately and succinctly described the elements of being a good Republican or Democrat. And then he said, but the real reason I'm a Democrat is because my dad was a Democrat. I know that. And on the way home, I remembered the baby elephant. And I realized I have a whole lifetime full of baby elephant beliefs. Stuff that I don't even know I know, but it's stuff that has to be true if I'm going to have a sense of well-being or feel good about myself and my life. One of the baby elephant beliefs, which did not help me, was that I'm separate from God. In the church I went to, they talked about God being up in heaven behind the pearly gates on the streets of gold. Now, you don't have to tell me you're separate from God. Later, they did tell me that. But if they would have said God was in Kansas City, then I know I'm separate from him because he's up in Kansas City. And then later, they told the Adam and Eve story and how I am separate from God. And God, I'll tell you, I felt it. I felt the separation. That become a fundamental baby elephant belief of mine. And also, they told us how to pray. When we're in trouble, we can beseech God in prayer. And if we behave the way we're supposed to behave, then God will answer the prayer and you can go on with your life. Well, the first time I remember praying and knowing who I was praying to and what I was praying for, it was Sunday morning. Wheat harvest would start Monday, but never Sunday in my church. And we fervently and sincerely prayed for God to not let it rain until after wheat harvest. And the farmers had brought the crops in. I mean, wheat was our breadbasket. And It rained that day. It hailed that day. The wind blew that day and ruined all the wheat in Sumner County, Kansas. And while nobody pointed their finger at me, I knew whose fault it was. Now, I had been taught from as early as I can remember that I need to be an individual achiever. And it was up to me. And somehow I had dropped the ball with God. And it had rained and destroyed the wheat crop. Now, if you're 4 or 5 years old, and you've assumed the entire responsibility for wiping out the Kansas wheat crop, what you have is an ego problem. The old ego, assuming responsibility for getting things done so that you'll have a sense of well-being, which you lack the power to do. And that became the way my whole life was. My parents and grandparents, well, all my grandparents came from Germany. And I don't mean happy-go-lucky Bavarian beer garden Germany. I mean, they were Prussians, and they were Nazis before Hitler even came into being. And Dad would, you know, I was the sixth kid born in 8 years in the Depression, and he's sick of kids, and he certainly don't have patience for any that just won't behave. And he was an alcoholic, and he was angry, and he was frightened, and he was afraid us kids wouldn't amount to anything. And he'd beat you. I mean, twice in my life I was beaten where it took weeks to get well. Now, that don't make you an alcoholic. But I never got where I like being beaten. Now, I understand in California, they've got people, they hang up there and they beat, and everybody likes it. I'm not like that. You beat me, and I'm going to cry. Today, I'm going to cry. It's too late to make a long story short, but I didn't feel good about my life. And when I was 12 years old, I drank about half a pint of whiskey. And I remember thinking, this is what it's like to feel good. This is what they mean when they say, let's go get a few drinks and get the feeling good. Now, I have heard people say that for the first time they knew what it was like to feel normal. I don't believe that. I believe whiskey makes me feel 2 to 3 times better than normal, and a hell of a lot better than I ever really need to feel. But our culture wants us to be competitive and to win the competition so that I can be the best or the boss in order to achieve prestige, money, and a position of authority where I can control my life and thereby have a sense of well-being. Can't make that work. I believe one of the reasons, now, I don't care. There's a neurotransmitter in each one of our central nervous systems. There are lots of these. Billions of these. And there's one called norepinephrine that activates the fight and flight center in your brain. It turns on your anger and your fear in your brain. Alcoholics is the class of people are in the top 15% in terms of abundance of norepinephrine. So we're spring-loaded for fear and fight. I mean, we've got a plenty for that. So when it comes time for competition, we've got what it takes to compete. Don't make a difference if you win or not, because there's a couple other neurotransmitters. One of them is called dopamine and the other serotonin, which were in the bottom 15% in terms of abundance, which turns on the pleasure centers. So biochemically, you're fixed to fight, but biochemically, you're not going to feel good. You're just not. And in doing the fighting, you end up with resentments, dishonesty, all of that stuff, which keeps the fight going. And you drink whiskey, and it sedates that norepinephrine system, and you feel 5 times better than normal. And you immediately become addicted, or very quickly, you become addicted to that. And you, as a personality, don't really have a hell of a lot to do with it. The tail starts dragging the dog, and you're going to go along with it. And your life goes down the tubes, and there isn't any bottom. And that's my experience. I drank, I felt good. Then I got a job as a process analyst. And I was good. I was a good analyst. I was half bright, and I just think logically sometimes. When I'm allowed to think, I think. But I can't write technical reports. And I'm criticized because I can do the analysis. I was a process analyst, and we analyze processes. And they want me to write reports, and I just get afraid. I get anxious, and I just freeze up, and it gets tighter and tighter, and I'm more and more worthless. And I took this stuff home to work on one Wednesday night, and same way at home, I'm telling you, I just froze up. And I didn't have anything particular in mind when I got up and went to the refrigerator. I guess I just wanted to see what was going on in the refrigerator. It may be God led me over there, but I'll tell you what was going on in there. There was a pint of whiskey that was about half drank that one of the neighbors brought over for my patio party Sunday, and he left it, and my wife was keeping it to take back to him. And I knew he wouldn't mind if I had a drink of his whiskey. And I poured about 2 ounces. I didn't drink during the week. And on the weekends, I drank beer, mostly. Well, I drank in the week if I had a chance, I'll tell you that. And it was whiskey if I had a chance for that. And I got Vanity's whiskey, and I was just sitting there at the table, just kind of sipping it, not gulping like an alcoholic would, but... And the thought came to me, why don't you start the report with a brief description of what prompted you to do this analysis in the first place? And then you can succinctly describe the significant results of the analysis. And then in conclusion, you can write recommendations to improve the process based on the analysis. I got up and went and got the bottle. I did. I sat down, and I was drinking, and I wrote a great report. I did not get drunk. I got brilliant. I can't be the only one in the room that has had this experience, but I wrote a report using technical language that I didn't even know I knew. It was just flowed, you know. And I took it into work, and that Friday, they had it typed up. Everybody signed it and sent it out. And the next Tuesday, my boss's boss's boss came out with my report and stood by my desk and said, Howard, did you write this report? I said, yes, sir. He said, this is a really good report. And I said, well, thank you. He said, we knew you could do it if you just give us the effort. My head said, effort, I gave you effort, and that didn't work. It was whiskey. But my head also said, don't tell him effort. Let him think effort. Don't tell him whiskey. They won't give you anything but a hard time for whiskey, and they'll give you a raise for effort. The important thing is, I know it's whiskey. And now I have the solution to feeling good and to function in difficult situations. And I start getting better assignments. And it got so good that I couldn't wait till Wednesday. I had to move to Monday night. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I would write reports and do the, do the stuff that was hard to do, and I do it at home. That adds more time in order to, and my job becomes everything. And then I got an assignment. I was working for General Dynamics Astronautics, and I got an assignment to summarize the test reports on Atlas missile failures, where they blew the missile up all over Cape Canaveral. Many of those were successful flights. And I did the analysis summarizing the cause of each failure and what was done to correct it and whether it ever happened again. This report turned out to make my division director a hero, which made me a best-selling author. And his Air Force counterpart was also delighted with my report. I had nothing to do with it except the analysis. But the analysis results made them look effective, which made me look good. And so I got promoted from a process analyst to an engineer and then to a senior engineer. And San Diego began to close down and dig out the harbor in order to become a tourist attraction. And I had a chance to go to Hughes Tool Company Aircraft Division in Culver City, California. And I've been a Howard Hughes fan since I was in eighth grade. And this was an exciting opportunity for me. And I went up there as a senior engineer. I became kind of a senior engineer and then the engineering supervisor. Again, whiskey was the answer. In about 1970, I had to drink so much whiskey before I got brilliant that my speech was slurred. I was thinking straight, but my damn tongue wouldn't work, and my lips, and my boss thought I was drunk, the people that I supervised thought I was drunk, and my wife thought I was drunk. Now, there's a word called synchronicity, which I think means a series of unrelated, random events come together and help life work in an orderly and harmonious way. I had synchronicity in my life at this time, and I went into the Tattletale, the bar I drank at, and there was a guy in there that was selling little white pills with crosses on them, which he stacked up and then wrapped tinfoil around the stack. You look at this and you think, heck, those look like lifesavers. Those are lifesavers. Benzedrine and booze helped me in every way in my life except controlling my body functions. And if you're taking Benzedrine and booze, you need help. And January of 1972, my boss, he had talked to me and talked to me and talked to me, he said, I'm going to take you out of management. You've lost credibility with me as a manager. You've lost credibility with the people that you manage. And if you don't get your drinking squared away, you aren't going to have a job, but you're going to report to me on special assignment. And he took 10% of my pay. And the only strokes I had in life by this time, is my job. And now I'm losing that. The person I really loved with all my heart, and if she, before she married me, my life was empty without her, was going to take our kids and leave. And I said, don't leave. I will quit drinking altogether. Just don't leave. And she said, okay, got to stop drinking. 4 days later, I said to her, we need to have a talk. We've been married for nearly 20 years. We have 3 kids. I need you. The kids need us. We can make this work. But if I can't drink at all, I guess you'll have to go. I hadn't wanted it to come to that, but that's where it was. It really was there. I said, all I'll do now, I can't not drink at all. All I'll do is drink a half a pint a day. And she stayed. Here's a bottom. Right there's a good solid bottom. And the way drinking a half a pint a day went for me was, I'd stop by the Tattletale and have 2 double shots at 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I'd go by the liquor store and get a half a pint. And I'd just going to baby that half a pint through the day. It would be gone by 11 in the morning at the earliest, or at the latest. And then my brain was working better. And my mind would say, well, you didn't really mean you were just going to drink exactly a half a pint a day. There's going to be days when you don't drink at all. I'm going to go out at lunch and get tomorrow's half a pint, and I'm just going to have a drink out of it. It's just one little drink, and then I can, that's all I want tomorrow is what's left. Tomorrow's half a pint is gone by 2:30, and then it's I'll drink if I want to. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm paying the bills. I wasn't paying the bills. We were going terribly into debt. But anyway, that's what I'd say. And I'd get that third half a pint, and then on the way home, I'd stop and get the fourth half a pint, even if I had some of the third left, so that I could go into the kitchen, break the seal in front of her on that other last half a pint, take a drink of it, and boy, it was a goddamn jungle out there today. I drink that half a pint and I pass out on the living room floor. And she's saying, he can't even, your dad can't even drink a half a pint anymore. She needed Al-Anon when we were in the 7th grade, I'm telling you. I was hopelessly in debt. My wife was leaving me. I was demoted. I had an opportunity to sell some equipment that I didn't own. Equipment that I found right before the federal government lost it. And I got it to a fence, and the fence ran off with the equipment. If he got money, he ran off. He got money, but he ran off with that too. And I'm back in the Tattletale asking these entrepreneurs. Whiskey had stopped making me smart. I mean, you got to be dumber than dirt to go in and talk to the guys in the Tattletale to see if they want electronic test equipment for their factories. They couldn't even keep a TV set turned in where you could see it. And the next morning was the 26th of July, 1972, and I woke up on page 8 in the big book. Now, I make up page numbers. I make up stuff that it says. Nobody ever checks. It adds credibility to my talk. I woke up on page 8 in the big book where it says, no words can express the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretches out in every direction. Quicksand. That's the bottom. When there is no bottom. When the character and quality of my life is sinking, plummeting, and there's nothing in my life to stop it. And the brilliant thought comes to me. You don't steal. One of the brilliant thought was, this is owned by the federal government. It's calibrated test equipment, so it's going to be recalled for recalibration when the calibration date is due. Nobody's going to find the equipment. And so then they go to security. Security ain't going to find nothing. And they're going to write a letter to the government saying, we've lost your equipment. It's worth more than $10,000, so they have to investigate. It's called the Federal Bureau of Investigation that does this. And I know the dumbest one of those guys, and they're not dumb, but the dumbest one of those guys is smart enough to go to the bars around the place and say, hey, do you know a place where I could buy electronic test equipment? And I know I have to stop drinking until this blows over. And when Pat was going to leave me the last time, she went to a lawyer, and he had said, your husband and you've been married for 20 years. You don't want a divorce. Why don't you get him to go to AA? It sounds like an alcoholic. And she came to me and said, the lawyer said, why don't you go to AA? It sounds like an alcoholic. I said, Pat, AA is for people whose lives are in trouble because of their drinking. If we aren't in any trouble, if you just get off my back. Oh, poor me. And now I'm thinking, I'm in a lot of trouble here. And going to AA would please Pat. And I knew the president of AA worldwide, who had been drinking in the Tattletale about 8 years ago. And he had disappeared, joined AA, and had been promoted right up the ladder to world president. We had our information straight in the Tattletale. I don't know about you guys in your bar, but in my bar, we were deep thinkers. I remember sitting there one at the bar, and I heard this guy say, nothing is as easy as it looks. If something can go wrong, it will go wrong, and at the worst possible time. I said, give me a piece of paper and a pencil. Would you tell me that again? I mean, that's important fundamental truth about the world right there. Life sucks, and then you die. Don't trust anyone. Now, I didn't just identify with those things. Those were fundamental truths about how I felt about life. And then it was worse than that. But I called Kenny. His name when he was drinking in the Tattletale was Kenny Sixbury. He joined AA and became Kenny S. So I called Kenny S. And I said, would you take me to an AA meeting sometime? And he said, how about tonight? He said, my group's a beginner's group. My home group's a beginner's group. And tonight's the beginner's group meeting. You'd really have a, this is the right time to go. I said, no, not tonight. I got stuff to do. I can't. But you know, he talked me into going. And on the way to the first meeting, I had just drank 3 half a pints and taken a lethal dose of Benzedrine through the day. And I said to him, I am not an alcoholic. And he said, well, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but I think we're going to the right place. He takes me in, and the only guy there is this old guy. And he's probably 60, an old guy. And he was taking notes in a leather notebook. And Kenny said to me, I want you to meet my sponsor. Frank, this is Howard. And Frank looked up and smiled. And Kenny said, "This is Howard's first meeting." Frank stood up slow, smiled, and said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, Howard. I hope you will join with us and that you will do the things that we do and that you don't do the things we don't do. And if you conform to that, in a relatively short time, your life will be magnitudes better than you ever dreamed it could be." Now, I heard him say that many times. That night, the thing that my mind said is, how the hell did he use the word magnitudes and do it right? When we read, one other thing, very, very important thing. In spite of my fundamental belief, don't trust anybody, I felt trust for Frank. And I felt it clear enough that I knew, I trust this guy. I didn't tell anybody that, but I know I felt the trust. And I didn't know why, and I didn't tell anybody, and I didn't ask. They said, anybody here in their first meeting, my hand goes up. And anytime it's somebody's first AA meeting, don't make any difference what the topic was going to be or what they're going to call on. They're going to say, well, the topic tonight is, what is an alcoholic and how do you stop drinking? Chuck, would you start out to share? Chuck was the old timer in the group. He is a film editor at MGM Studios there in Culver City. And he got up and he talked about going to the backstage bar after work just to have two drinks, three at the most. And the next thing you knew, it was the last call for alcohol. And he knew his watch was right and their clock was 10 minutes fast. And he's arguing, you got plenty of time to give me another double shot. And by God, I want it. Now, what happened? He wasn't going to have but two drinks. Now he's closing the place up, fighting for another double. He said he not only did that Monday night, he did it Tuesday, and every time he was just going to have two, three at the most. And he said, I just got myself in trouble at work, got myself in trouble at home, I got hopelessly into debt, and, you know, it sounds like a real story to me. I'm identifying with this, and then he said, and I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find out that I drink like that because I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. The loss of control is characterized by this insane, obsessive belief each time they go by the backstage bar that they're just going to have two drinks, three at the most. But coupled with that insane obsession is a physical reaction that manifests itself in a phenomenon of craving for more once they start to drink. And once that happens, they can't stop. And he said, I found out that I was an alcoholic and that I had to stop drinking. Now, each person that was called on had a similar kind of story. And each one of them, it seemed to me, mentioned the phenomenon of craving. Now, I had seen The Lost Weekend with Ray Milland. I saw it fairly recently. And once again, what Ray Milland did in that movie was have a phenomenon of craving. And I never had that. I mean, hell, he was selling his prized possession, a typewriter, for a drink, 6 o'clock in the morning. I never got that bad. If I ever got that bad, I'd have come to AA, but I couldn't wait until the break. I didn't even know we had a break, but we had a break. And I went over to Kenny and I said, well, I identify with nearly everything they say, but they are saying that a phenomenon of craving, once you start, separates alcoholics from the non-alcoholics. And I never craved a drink, so I must be a non-alcoholic. Well, he said, okay, what time did you start drinking? And I said, about 6 in the morning. And he said, why did you start so early? And I said, because I had a hangover. And it's the only way I can get rid of a hangover. Okay, he said, I understand that. Now, once you got rid of the hangover, did you keep drinking? I knew he had me. But not really, because I told him the truth. I kept drinking because I wanted another drink. But I didn't crave another drink. I just wanted one. He said, the craving only comes when the guy, the alcoholic, takes a drink and then doesn't take another one. If an alcoholic keeps slugging them down so fast, the craving never has an opportunity to set in. I think, well, maybe I'm an alcoholic. I got drunk as I could get, stayed drunk for a week. And on August 4th, I had my last drink, my last Benzedrine. And the next Monday, Kenny and I went to a meeting. And after the meeting, we sat out in the truck to talk. And I said, Kenny, I don't believe that God participates in life. I believe in God, but my fundamental belief, as far as religion is concerned, is that it is a human intellect situation, has nothing to do with divine revelation, and that the Creator doesn't change anything in order to accommodate people and their problems or their prayers. And I'm not going to work the steps. Now, can I still be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And he said, to me, in retrospect, one of the most wonderful things anybody has said, and he said, Howard, let's just make your entire AA program be, you're going to go to a meeting every night for 30 nights in a row. That's it. You don't have to stop drinking. And it'll be better if you do. But he said, I didn't stop drinking until after I was coming in for a while. But I'd say, better if you don't drink. And otherwise, you don't have to do anything but go to a meeting. He didn't say, get a sponsor, work the steps, any of that. Because he knew if you're going to a meeting, everybody's going to say that there. You can't escape it. And one night, it was a Thursday night, we're on our way to the meeting. We went Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we went Tuesday, Wednesday, and on Thursday, he's telling me on the way to the meeting, the thing that worked best for me was to listen to what the people were sharing. And when somebody that seems to have what I wanted shared, and they shared something that sounded like it would enhance my life, I would try to take that home and add it to my program. And right after that, I heard a guy say, if you make one mistake and brood about that mistake, you've made two mistakes. And the brooding is frequently the worst consequence of making the first mistake. Man, that makes sense. I'm going to take that home and make that part of my program. Well, that's a good idea and it's a good thing, but I couldn't not brood. You know, I couldn't not brood. I heard Ski from San Diego say, I was 36 years in learning that all the people that I hated didn't feel the hate. And it's killing me. Man, I'm going to take that home. You know, I'm going to not hate. I hate every damn buddy. I'm going to stop hating them. I can't do it. But I tell you what I'm doing, and I don't know it. I'm taking hope home. with me from AA. And hope is a great thing to start out with. I hoped that I was going to not brood. I hoped that I wasn't going to hate. That's a good thing to take home. The fact I can't do it, if I just keep going to meeting, I'll hear Archie Johnson say, "I was so busy this week wanting what I was getting that I didn't have time to worry about getting what I wanted." And in AA, we try to learn to live in the now, right now. And whatever's happening right now, including my talk, love that. Because that's what's going to happen anyway. And not loving what's going to happen anyway is one of our greatest sources of restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. My head said, "Well, let's stick him in the eye with a sharp stick. Let's see him love that." Because that's the way my head worked. But we went outside, and it's raining as hard as it can rain in the Pacific Palisades in California. I mean, it was torrents of rain. And I've hated the rain since I wiped out the wheat crop. And I make it to the car, and I'm soaked to the skin. Now, my head has always talked to me. Popped off. You know, when the first night I was in AA and they read, the first night they read, "Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful." And I remember thinking, cunning? Alcohol isn't cunning. Cunning requires intellect. Alcohol doesn't have an intellect. Boy, they got that screwed up. Then they said, "But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now." They just got through saying alcohol is powerful. Now they say God has all power? That can't be. If God has all power, alcohol don't have power. If God has power, God doesn't have all power. He just has all power except what alcohol had. The fatal flaw with that kind of thinking is, while you're doing it, you're missing stuff that could save your life. But if you're there every night and trying to listen, you'll hear something else that you can pop off about. That night when I got into the car, my head said, "Love the rain, Howard. That's what Archie was talking about. That's what Will Rogers was talking about. That's what Mark Twain was talking about. Everybody cusses the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Why don't you just love it?" I went home and dried off and took a shower and got in bed. And we have wooden shingles, and I could hear it on the... And it was soothing, and I loved the rain. Now, I loved the rain. How could that be? I think it was... If I had asked somebody with time, they would have said, that's what we call God's grace. It's God's gift of goodness to you to trust Frank Giroux. It's God's goodness given to you as a gift, as grace, that you love the rain so that you can find a foothold. And if you keep doing this, just... Here and then I heard, I had quit AA a lot of times, I'm telling you. And this time I was pushing the lawnmower. I wouldn't have been doing this if my wife hadn't been mad at me. And I didn't, I'm a week late on mowing the lawn, and it hit a tree root, and my chest hit a bowl on the, it held the handle on. It hurt. If you want a little test, take a ball peen hammer and whack yourself hard right there on it. I mean, that hurt. And my immediate reaction was, "Damn Pat, anyway." That's my wife. Now, that was my reaction because that's always my reaction. Damn somebody. Things ain't going right for me. And then it was, damn AA. AA don't work. If AA worked, would my chest hurt? I don't think so. I'm not going to those meetings and grin like a baboon and say, isn't this wonderful? When it's not wonderful, it's never going to be wonderful. I'm not going to drink, but I'm not going to go. It was Saturday night, and Clarence came and got me, and I was halfway to Malibu's meeting and saying, isn't this wonderful? You know, and when I got there, Jack Bailey welcomed me, and he was a celebrity, and he lifted up newcomers. He always told us how good we were doing and how proud he was of us. And you know, and then I heard Don Gates again. And in Don's talk, he said, if you're new in AA or if you're old and you're not working the steps, AA will stop being fun. And you'll decide AA doesn't work. You'll decide you're not going to the meetings anymore. Now, if you don't go to the meetings, the day will come when you go to the bar and you ask the bartender for a double shot. And he's going to say, what's the matter? I thought you were going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't Alcoholics Anonymous work? He said, if you're not working the steps, be honest with him and tell him you don't know if it would work or not because you didn't try. And there was nothing in my head to pop off at that. And I made a commitment that night to work the steps. And very quickly I took the first half of the first step. Very quickly I skipped the second half, the second step, and the third step. But I did a great first inventory. And I was a battered child. And when I, in 1960, I had a breakdown. I worked myself into collapsing, and then I couldn't stop crying. And I went to the therapist that I had gone to in college with abnormal psychology, and he spent about 5 weeks with me. And then in the fifth week, he told me my problem was in my relationship with my dad and with authority. I did not know how to react with ever who was authority over me or ever who was subordinate to me. And he said, now, when he got through talking to me about that, I could see some truth in that. And then he said, well, you have insight into this. I think enough insight so you can work your way out of it. He said, we could keep going to therapy, but you can't afford it, and I can't afford to do it pro bono. So let's give it a try, and you come back in a month. Well, I was playing golf that Sunday, and I hit the ball, and it sliced. And at first, I was ready to throw my club. And then I thought, I don't care if I play golf good or not. I'm trying to please Dad. You know, and I'm telling you, I set myself a new road pathway that any time there was any problem, it was my dad. It just became automatic, and it was that way for a long, long time. If it wasn't my dad, it was Pat, or it was you. It was always, but mostly it was my dad. And when I did my first inventory and listed all my resentments, most of them about Dad, at the end, my head said, Howard, your dad isn't your problem, is he? He died in 1951. This is 1973. He is not your problem. Your problem is you're terrified, and the only way you can get out of that terror is being angry and fight your way through and be dishonest and self-seeking. And the only way that you can feel good is short-term pleasures that don't address the long-term problem, whether it's whiskey, Benzedrine, or whatever. Now, I think it's a miraculous thing that I got that. I didn't know what I was going to do about it. I did a fifth step. I was carrying fifth step things in my head. When I was a little kid, I was molested by a Protestant school teacher, by the way. We got to clean it up for the Catholic priest. This was a Protestant school teacher. It wasn't that big a deal, but I was ashamed and always had that on the back of my mind. When I'm 40 years old, I'm not going to put that in my fourth step. And then I decided I'll put it in my fourth step, but I'm not going to do it in the fifth step. 40 years old, and this was something when I was a kid. And when we started to do the fifth step, I said to the guy, Kenny had moved out of town, and I had a new sponsor, and I said, well, how do you want to do this, George? And he said, why don't you start telling me the stuff you decided not to tell me? Tell me that first and get that out of the way, and then we'll do the easy stuff next. And I'd be damned if I didn't do it, you know? And it was hard to do. I can't explain it other than that, but I will tell you, within a week or 10 days, I noticed that that wasn't haunting me anymore. And I was no longer blaming Dad. Now that is a transformation of, you know, major proportions in a life as screwed up as mine was. And my boss put me back in management. Pat told me and she went to Al-Anon. And she said, my sponsors explained to me, and she said, I agree with her. I'm never going to threaten to leave you again. Because when we do that, and nobody goes anyplace, we don't address the problem. So we're going to stay together and we're going to fight it out. Getting a promotion is a good thing. But let me tell you, it's stressful. It adds stress to your life. Getting a commitment that you're going to stay together is a good thing. But it means I'm going to have to give some things up. I don't know what it is, but I know that this is stressful. And Pat's going to, and I'm getting invited to speak. I was very young in AA when I started getting invited to speak, and I wanted Pat to go with me, and she'd go. And Fresno's an all-night trip, and I said, we're going back to Fresno. And she said, honey, I'm not going to go to Fresno with you this time. Well, I heard that, but I know she's going. I've just got to sweeten the pot, you know. I've got to offer her something to make this a better deal than just going to Fresno. And I said, you know, we had a great time in Fresno the last time. She said, I know it, but Fresno's only good for one good time. I mean, but I know she's going to go. And when the time came, I said, remember, tomorrow, Saturday, we're going to go to Fresno. And she said, honey, I love you, and we're going to be together forever. And if it causes you pain for me not to go to Fresno with you, I want you to know I love you enough to help you go through the pain. I went to my sponsor. I said, she has become completely unreasonable. I said, she won't listen to reason. She'll listen, but she'll say, well, I only have one reason. You always have better reasons than I do, but my reason is I don't want to go. And my sponsor says no is a complete answer. Well, Al-Anon has ruined my marriage. And I go in to tell my sponsor, and he said, sounds like we need to go through the steps again. I said, I don't think she's ever gone through the steps. He said, oh, no, not her, you. God, I can't believe it. And we went through the steps again, this time the second half of the first step before I skipped, you know. And the second half, my sponsor made me say, I fully concede to my innermost self that I am a victim of the insane delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. If I can only have my way. I've only had one problem in my life, ever. And that's, I'm not having my way. I found out in this inventory that I'm a total taker. A total taker in every area of my life. At work, at home, in the neighborhood, and in AA. I'm less that in AA, but I'm a taker. And I didn't even know that. Do you really? I did not know it. And it was clear as a bell. And then when you see it, it kind of helps you want to change. And I'll talk about meditation tomorrow. I'll just tell you, I learned to meditate very early. And I just hit and miss on the meditation. I was reading in 12 and 12. Used to be on page 77. I think it's 75 now. Who's going to check? We have to stop using our higher power as some kind of a Bush League pinch hitter. Now, I knew meditation helped me. I did not think God participated in it, but frequently in my meditation, at the end of the meditation, an answer would come to me, which I thought come from the human intellect. If you just calm your mind, the answer will come from your brain. I don't see it as coming from any spiritual place. But it's working. You see, I don't believe it's God, but it's working. I believe airplanes fly because of the aerodynamic principles, which are really a manifestation of God. But airplanes fly whether you believe it's God or not, if you just apply the principles. And meditation was a principle, and it lifted my life, just like working the steps lifted my life. And my life was good. I got promoted. I finally reached my career goal. I look at my watch, not to see what time it is, but to give you guys a sense of optimism. That I care what time it is. I don't care. I got my career goal. And I was now the manager of a technical section in the systems engineering department. This is a lifetime goal. And I didn't know, as a baby elephant believed, I was as much affected by the idea that I learned as a child about the little train that could. But not just the little train, but everything I was taught, I somehow believed that I think I can, I think I can, I know I can, I know I can, and then I get it done. And when I finally get there, it's going to be a downhill drag forever. The stress will be gone once you reach the goal. Now, I know my life is stressful, but I'm not at the top yet. Now I reached my goal, and the stress was gone for 2 days. And my boss came in on the second day with an assignment that was just out of my... it was a tough assignment. I had to make a presentation to a 2-star general and his staff. He was a military director of the Apache program, and he was concerned about a technical system being ready for the first production aircraft. And in August, he said, if he's not convinced by October, he's not going to recommend production. And they picked me to make the presentation. Well, I'm the wrong guy. I'm going to embarrass the company. I'm going to, and I tell this to my boss, and he said, you know, this promotion you got, and along with it, a 30% pay increase? Big raise back then. Big raise, an impossible raise now. And he implied that if I didn't make this presentation, I was in jeopardy with my job. Now, I meditate every day. I started meditating on the 1st of October, 1974. I meditated for 30 minutes a day, and I didn't miss a day until July of 2002. And then I had open heart surgery and I missed some time. But up till then, I was an everyday meditator. Never missed. And this morning, I sat there the day after the assignment, and basically what I did was was feel the dreadfulness of the work assignment I had. And then the next day, I focused on the dreadfulness for about 10 minutes, and then I got into the meditation. And at the end of the meditation, I had a sense of well-being, just like I always do. And but when my timer goes off, I know, don't back out. Don't stop this, because you're just going to back out into dreadfulness. And my head said, why can't I just feel a sense of ease and comfort? Why can't I just have a sense of well-being? Why do I have to get into this razzmatazz? And then I saw, in my mind's eye, a frozen lake. Now I'm thinking, why? What's this about? You know? But I ain't backing out. And then I know, because it's my fantasy, for those of you who are more spiritual, it's my vision, that the ice is as thick as the laws of physics will allow ice to get, and that you could put a Sherman tank on that ice and it would support it. And I had that thought, and then I was going to say a voice. I had that thought, and then another thought was, walking across the lake a step at a time is a good metaphor for living your life a day at a time. Be careful, because it's slippery. And by the way, if you're not absolutely certain that the ice is thick enough to support you, you're going to dread every step you take. Every day can be filled with dread. Then I could back out. And when I backed out, I made a commitment. I'm going to make the presentation. I may sink the ship, but I'm going to make the presentation, and I'm going to work on coming to believe. I'll tell you, if you've made the group your higher power, when you've got a really tough presentation to make, they ain't going to show up. Just a little clue to me. And I knew I need to be convinced that I'm supported in my life by some power that I can have a sense of well-being on. And I went back through the steps. We agnostics, Bill talks about seeing the goodness in religion. Okay. But then he says, the prosaic steel girders are made up of electrons whirling around each other at incredible speeds in accordance with precise law. I remember when I first read that, and hundreds of times or ever, how many times I read it, thinking, Bill don't know anything about electrons. This is one of the dumbest ways to describe electrons. They do whirl around each other in a rough way, but they really whirl around baryons, protons, and neutrons. And if you've got that attitude, it just carries right on through the rest of the paragraph, I'm telling you. And this time I read it, and it says, science tells us so, and we have no reason to doubt it. The perfectly logical assumption is that underneath the material world and life as you see it, there's an all-powerful guiding creative intelligence underlying the material world and life as you see it. Now, I know that order and harmony underlies my vision, because my vision is principally interactive with light from 13 billion light years away, captured by the Hubble telescope. That's an amazing thing to me. That light and my vision have been 13 billion light years away, and now they're principally interacting. That gives me a hint of some kind of oneness in the universe that constitutes the possibility of a spirit underlying the totality of things, manifesting precise law, order, harmony, and goodness. And it gets wherever place I look in science, I see that. And I started trusting. Now, I didn't will myself to assent that there was a divine order. I went through the steps. I saw every fear I ever had either didn't happen, or it did happen and the consequences were the best things that could have happened. And I read that from the bottom up. I didn't start in with that. I came out with it. My experience, I have validated in my life the pervasive presence of divine order. The presence of all the power and intelligence necessary in any circumstance and event in the universe to produce a right outcome. That has happened in my life. But I've been taught to be an individual achiever. So whatever sense of well-being I had ever had, it was because of an achievement. The road to the achievement was stressful. AA is teaching me to trust. If that's true, if this thing is going to happen down the road, then everything necessary for it to happen down the road is happening right now. If I'm convinced of that, I can trust it in my life and have a sense of well-being in the face of what appears to me to be adversity. It just makes sense. On page 93, whatever concept of God you have will work for you provided it makes sense to you. This makes sense to me, and we can each find our own way in this thing. And as reading the book on meditation, it says, if you just feel God's presence and you're conscious of that, that's the right way for you. But if you have to analyze finely tuned processes in order to see order, harmony, and unfolding goodness, that's the right way for you. But wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. Alcoholics Anonymous is my window. This is where I see God pass. Thank you very much for letting me share.
Thank you, Howard, very much. Howard?